Blog Talk Radio.
Topic is going to be the assassination of John F. Kennedy. During the time of counting our blessings, as with hello everyone and welcome to your place. Tonight our topic is going to be the assassination of John F. Kennedy. During the time of counting our blessings, as with many of you, Wild Bill keeps looking at things that have occurred during his life. He was just a small boy in 1963, but the things he saw on the television have left a mark in his mind all of these years. In November of 1963, he was only 5 years old, but has vivid pictures he remembers of the news events of the shooting and the funeral of JFK. I would guess that this probably impacted his family, and he was feeding his emotions off of them. There have been hundreds of conspiracy theories. There are even new blogs with new theories and reasons for what happened. Hundreds of books and movies have been made in regards to the event. It's clear that during a time of hope, with younger people starting to take more interest in politics, that nobody dreamed such an event could take place. One of the supervising Secret Service agents from that time had finally had enough of all the things said and published. He published a book on the topic. He used reports and personal notes of the agents involved and their personal recollections based on these reports to put together as much of the facts as possible. We tried to screen as much of the gory details as possible from what we are sharing tonight. Secret Service agent Clint Hill was part of Mrs. Kennedy's protection detail and was on the backup vehicle. He was the agent that made it to the car first. 12 years later, and for the first time, he shared what happened. You will hear this. The show may run a little bit longer than usual, but we want you to hear the comment. We want to hear your comments at the end of the show. The Bible tells us that life is just a vapor. It is clear that on this beautiful day that nobody thought this could happen. There is another event coming soon that will catch many people unaware if they are not careful. And give me just a second so I can find the clip.
Well, hello, Starla. Thank you so much for sharing what our show is going to be about tonight, and I hope that everyone can get something from this. I do want to make a recommendation. If you have small children that listen to our show, tonight would not be a good night for them to listen to this before you do. We took a lot of effort to really go through and screen a lot of the information from this, but we wanted to make it as complete on the actual what happened as far as historical as possible, and it's troubling to me as an adult, so I'm sure that this would be something that you wouldn't want most children to listen to. Many people are probably asking, why in the world would you even want to cover a topic like this? Well, for one thing, as you get older, you realize that you look at things more in a broad scope. And when you were younger, you looked at things more narrow as to what you were wanting to do that day or the next day. It just was a different viewpoint. And to make an example of that, when I was a teenager, if I wanted to go cruising, you know, till 1 o'clock in the morning, down a certain area where all the kids hung out and cruised, I didn't worry about the price of gas. Now that I'm older, I try to make everything on a route to where I don't have to double back, and I try to cover everything at one time while I'm out to try to save how much miles I put on my car and the gas. You know, you just look at things different. And I'm here to tell you that today, with the price of gas, what it is, there's teenagers and young people today that they just do what they want to do. They don't worry and they don't think about those things. They don't really fret about it. You know, it's just like it was when I was a teenager back in the 70s. It's the same thing as what it is in this day and time of 2012. It's just different focus on things. And one of the things you see when you get to look and you start seeing patterns, that a lot of things are cyclical in the way they run. But what seems to me is kind of like where, of course, this is going back a little historical event, where you used to have to wind a watch. After having a watch for a while and winding it several times, it's like the spring would kind of stretch out in there, and it got to where it didn't keep real good time. And that's what it kind of feels like to me sometimes as you look at things as it goes back through its different patterns. It seems like it's off just a little bit. The rhythm's not quite there. You know, there's a little bit of wang to the music where it's kind of just stretched out of time and out of sync. And so you become more aware. And I wanted people to have this historical event to kind of look back as you look on things today. I did want to point out a few things during this show that you won't be able to probably grasp from the show. One of the things I would like to say is most of the excerpts of what you get tonight came from a book. It was written by from reports of Secret Service agents by one Secret Service agent that was actually part of the Kennedy detail. And I recommend that all of you read this book. It's the Kennedy detail. There's an audio version of it, and it's really one of those things that is worth covering. When you get to understanding the chaos of what was going on during that time, and then you get to thinking of all the conspiracy theories and things come out of it, you can sort of see, you know, and I've tried to put it out there as much information as possible to cover why some of the things happened, what they did, where people try to make it part of a conspiracy theory after that. But one of the things that, you know, I also want to get people to look at is how it can seem like a bright, sunshiny day, Everything's going good. Everything's going great in your life. And all of a sudden, boom. And we have an appointment coming in all of our lives. We don't ever know when it's going to come. The Bible tells us life is but a vapor. And as you know, a vapor is one of those things that doesn't last very long. And it also lets us know that there's a day coming where, like a thief in the night, that God's coming back for his bride. And it could be one of these days like this. And I want to encourage everyone to be sure that you're ready for when that day comes. A couple of things I wanted to point out. It was really unusual for the president and vice president to be together in the same place. But you also have to realize that they were starting their campaign for their, you know, it's his third year of his presidency. They were on the campaign trail. They were starting to go out to get ready for the next election. John F. Kennedy was a Yankee from Massachusetts. And here his vice president was from Texas. And so he had the vice president meet him there as they were doing this campaign tour. But another thing, I can't find any other time where the president's wife, Jackie, was there with him while he was doing one of these things. She had been with him in Florida, and then they came over to this in Texas. So there was a lot of things that had never happened before. As you know, Secret Service agents are assigned to the president, the vice president, the president's wife had her own detail, and the children had their own detail. Back during that time, people that were running for office, they did not have Secret Service coverage like they do today. Matter of fact, I think it was Johnson that put that into place years later when Robert Kennedy was assassinated, when he put in his bid to run for office. And so there's a lot of things that changed during that time. They didn't have a lot of manpower during that time. Secret Service that worked all day with the president, instead of getting to go to bed at the end of their day, if they were going to be somewhere else the next day, they became part of the advance group to go and set everything up to be ready for when they got there, to make sure all the security was in place to, you know, take care of whatever had to be done. And then when the president got there, they had to go right back to work again. So these men were very dedicated, worked a lot of hours. They didn't have the technology we have today. They didn't have little earpiece radios and things that you see on all the movies in this day and time. The radio at that time was what you saw in the Vietnam era wars. It was a radio probably between 12 to 18 inches long, weighed about 30 pounds. And, you know, that's what they had, and other than the radios that were mounted in a car. When you get to look into this custom-made car that was made, you can look at pictures online. People were like, why was the agent not able to get to the president that was there in the car? You have to realize where they were. You have to understand they were transitioning to get ready. They were 5 minutes away from the destination where they were going. You know, everything looked like it was on track. They were at the place where they were fixing to pick up speed. They were inside of the interstate. You know, all these things were playing into what was going to go into the end of a great day, when all of a sudden, in 6 seconds, their whole world was turned upside down. So anyway, I hope that you could kind of think about that time a little bit and realize how things were different. From what I remember, you had 3 television channels. After the 10 o'clock news was over, most of the channels went off the air except on weekends, and they stayed on a little bit later after that. Then you got this little Indian symbol thing that would come on, and you got a beep that played, and that's it. You know, there was nothing else. You know, it's not like in this day and time we live in today. Once it got dark, most businesses folded up and shut the doors. Most states had what they called a blue law. You cannot get alcoholic beverages on Sundays. And a lot of places had things after a certain time of night. You couldn't. Some of the bars that were open during that time, they also were starting to get into the thing where they served food. After a certain time, you know, they weren't allowed to serve drinks. Even if they were open, they could still serve food. So it was a totally different time as far as what was available and what was going on. But I hope that you can tell from what you're hearing the dedication of these men that did the job. And I hope I covered everything. For whatever conspiracy theory that you believe, this kind of puts it in detail to let you understand the chaos that was there, why things happened like they did, and so you can sort of disprove those things in your own mind. So, Starla, we're going to turn it back over to you, and I hope everyone enjoys the show. We also look forward to hearing your comments at the end.
6 seconds in Dallas. The courage of life is often a less dramatic spectacle than the courage of a final moment, but it is no less a magnificent mixture of triumph and tragedy. John F. Kennedy. When the president's backup plane arrived at Love Field, Paul Landis from Mrs. Kennedy's detail was the first one off the plane. He was surprised to see the large crowd lined up behind the 5-foot chain link fence. There had to be about 2,000 people gathered to greet the president. Wasn't Dallas a Republican stronghold? When Emory Roberts had told him he'd be working the follow-up car today, he was more than a little surprised. He had just assumed that as the number two man for Mrs. Kennedy, he would be sent to the Trade Mart. It wasn't normal to have two agents from the First Lady's detail on the follow-up car. Landis was known for his practical jokes and good sense of humor, and he decided to have a little fun. He walked over to driver agent Sam Kinney, who was standing right next to the Secret Service follow-up car. "Hey, Sam," he said with a quizzical look on his face, looking everywhere but at the car directly in front of him. "I'm supposed to be in the follow-up car. You know where it is?" Sam laughed and played along. "Yeah, I think I saw it way over there," he said, pointing back toward the airplane hangar, several hundred yards away. "You better get on over there." Meanwhile, Wynne Lawson walked calmly alongside the fence, scanning the enthusiastic crowd. He, too, was surprised at how many folks had shown up and were waiting in anticipation for what would likely be a once-in-a-lifetime glimpse of John F. and Jacqueline Kennedy. Most of the spectators looked as if they had taken great care with their appearance for the occasion. Men were dressed in suits and ties, their shoes polished to a high shine, while the women were nearly all wearing knee-length dresses or skirts with high heels. One young man in a plaid button-down shirt stood atop a platform at the back of the crowd, holding a huge Texas flag. Farther down, another man waved a Confederate flag. A dozen or so people held signs welcoming Jackie and President Kennedy to the Lone Star State, but there were also a few scattered throughout the crowd, raising handmade signs with slogans like, "Yankee, go home," and "You're a traitor." Clearly, these were anti-Kennedy folks, but rarely did somebody with a picket sign pose a serious threat to the president. Sure, they could agitate the rest of the well-meaning crowd, but in reality, it was the hidden loner the Secret Service agents worried about most, the individual who'd come alone and whose eyes revealed the intense determination of someone who wanted to make a name for himself. Lawson looked up and saw Paul Landis walking toward him. "When Emory told me I'm supposed to man the follow-up car. I just wanted to double-check. Is that right?" Paul asked. Wynne looked at his advance report. "Yep, that's right." The vice president's plane had arrived, and a minute later, Air Force One came into view. Slowly, gracefully, the elegant silver, blue, and white airplane landed on the runway, a picture-perfect grand entrance for the television cameras that were broadcasting live on the local Dallas and Fort Worth TV stations. The animated crowd clapped and hollered right on cue. As the plane taxied to a stop less than 50 yards from the gaping crowd, Agent Wynne Lawson walked toward the stairs where the President and Mrs. Kennedy would descend from the plane. His eyes scanned the crowd, watching for anything unusual, anybody moving suddenly to the front of the fence. The President and Jackie would walk down the stairs, unguarded by any Secret Service agents, so the cameras could capture the couple alone. They'd been told not to dawdle, to move quickly to the bottom of the stairs, where Wynne and the other agents would suddenly appear at their sides. The back door of the airplane opened, and as Jackie emerged, with the president directly behind her, the crowd went into an absolute frenzy. Standing at the top of the steps, the couple paused for just a split second to look at the impressive crowd on the other side of the fence. Then, smiling as if they were truly thrilled to be arriving in the great city of Dallas, the president and his wife quickly and deliberately descended the portable metal staircase. The spectators were so focused on Jackie in her bright pink suit, and the president looking so tanned and handsome, that they probably hadn't noticed the Secret Service agents disembarking from the front of the plane, moving rapidly toward the rear stairwell. As soon as Jackie stepped onto the pavement, Agent Clint Hill was within an arm's length of her. ATSAIC Emery Roberts and ASAIC Roy Kellerman seemed to appear out of nowhere and were suddenly inches from President Kennedy. Straight-faced and serious, Emery Roberts darted eyes unseen behind his black sunglasses as Roy Kellerman moved in tandem with the president down the reception line. Clint Hill watched as the Dallas mayor's wife, Deary Cabell, handed Jackie a huge bouquet of red roses. It was a bit strange, he thought. At every other stop, the people had brought yellow roses, the famous yellow roses of Texas. Jackie, of course, made no mention of the fact and accepted the flowers gracefully, like it was the most extraordinary bouquet she'd ever been given. The onslaught of noise was overpowering. Beyond the engines, whistles and yells seemed to come from every direction. "Welcome to Dallas, Mr. President." "Jackie, over here! Look over here!" Lots of people had brought their brownie cameras and were holding them above their heads, hoping to get a decent shot over the crowd. The schedule called for the entourage to move through the official greeters and proceed directly to their assigned cars. And for a brief moment, Wynne thought the president was actually going to follow the plan. But when President Kennedy turned toward the eager crowd and saw the hands reaching out toward him, the voices urging him to come and say hello, Wynne knew it would be at least a few more minutes before the motorcade was on its way. As the president walked deliberately to the fence and began shaking the outstretched hands, the crowd was going wild. People were moving closer and closer together, vying for the prime spots next to the fence. Jack Kennedy was in his element. He loved being among the people. The closer, the better. Jackie, not knowing what else to do, followed her husband's lead and offered her own white-gloved hand to the adoring crowd. Emery Roberts, Roy Kellerman, Clint Hill, and Paul Landis moved along with the Kennedys, their eyes watching every hand as it was held out, ready to jump if they saw so much as a flicker of metal or a grasp that held on a second too long. Wynne Lawson took a deep breath as he surveyed the scene, making sure the agents were spread out effectively and the cars and other passengers in the motorcade were ready to go as soon as President Kennedy gave the word. This is where the detailed teamwork was essential. With no portable radios, the agents relied on hand signals and eye contact to point out targets that the roaming agents could respond to. Vice President and Lady Bird Johnson waited near the leased Lincoln convertible that would follow the Secret Service follow-up car. Governor John Connally and his wife Nellie stood near the presidential limousine. They'd be sitting on the fold-down seats in between the front and rear bench seats, but it wouldn't be appropriate for them to take their places before the president was in the car. As the Kennedys walked along the fence, driver agent Bill Greer inched the presidential limousine forward alongside them. If the situation turned dangerous, he needed to be as close as possible so they could jump in the car for a quick getaway. The Irish-born Greer had been John F. Kennedy's driver since the day he was elected, and he knew this car better than anybody. He knew that because of the weight and length of the car, he had to slow down when turning a corner, so the passengers in the back didn't get thrown to the side. And God forbid, if he ever did have to make a sudden getaway, he knew the 7,500-pound car, with its 300-horsepower engine, just didn't gather speed as quickly as he would like. Finally, the president shook one last hand, thanked the crowd for coming out, and looked toward Jackie, signaling her with a quick nod. He'd had enough and was ready to go. Governor Connally entered the president's limo and pulled up the jump seat so the Kennedys could slide into their positions in the back. Clint Hill, always anticipating where he should be to best protect Mrs. Kennedy, walked around to the left side of the car and stood at the fender, scanning the crowd as she sat down and smoothed out her skirt. She placed the bouquet of red roses on the seat next to her and looked up at Clint Hill with a smile, raising her hands to her eyes to shield them from the blinding sun, which was almost directly overhead. There was not a cloud in the sky. Roy Kellerman held the door for President Kennedy and noticed him wince ever so slightly as he stepped into the back of the limousine next to Jackie on the right-hand side of the car. Once the president and Jackie were settled, Governor Connally and Nellie flipped open the jump seats and sat down, with Nellie on the left, directly in front of Jackie, and the governor on the right, in front of the president. Sometimes President Kennedy would raise the hydraulic lift, elevating him another 10 inches, so he was even more visible. But this crowd, he knew, had come to see Jackie as much as they'd come for him. He wasn't about to block their view. Still, with his height and the way the car was designed, he sat a good 3 or 4 inches higher than Governor Connally. Jackie pulled out her sunglasses from her small handbag and put them on. The president looked at her and shook his head. "Jackie, take those off," the president said, slightly irritated. "The people have come to see you." Roy Kellerman sat down in the front passenger seat of the presidential limousine, picked up the radio receiver, and pressed the transmission button. "Lancer departing," he said, relaying to Wynne Lawson, who held a portable radio in the lead car directly in front of him. Wynne Lawson took his seat in the white, unmarked Ford sedan as Chief Curry put the car in gear and began following the police motorcycles in front of the procession. Wynne looked at his watch. 11:55 a.m., just 5 minutes late. With any luck, they might be able to make up some time along the way and still be at the Trade Mart by 12:30. As Sam Kinney kept the car moving at the same pace as the president's limousine, Jack Reedy, Paul Landis, and Tim McIntyre dropped back to their positions on the running boards. In his left side mirror, Bill Greer saw Clint Hill still jogging alongside the car, with his hand resting on the side of the midnight blue limousine, inches behind Jackie, even as the car sped up. On the right side, Don Lawton, the designated departure advance agent, slipped into position next to the president, as Jack Reedy dropped back to the follow-up car and trotted along like Clint, with a big grin on his face. On the trips to Tampa and San Antonio, Don Lawton had worked the follow-up car, but now he was relegated to handling the departure. He might as well enjoy the honor of working the motorcade briefly before he started the advance. Finally, Clint Hill dropped back into position on the left running board of the follow-up car as Bill Greer picked up the speed. Don Lawton was still jogging alongside. Emery Roberts stood up and motioned him back. Lawton turned to the follow-up car with a big grin and put up his arms in mocking protest as he dropped back to the sidelines. "Okay, I've done my job, guys," Lawton said. "It's all yours now. Now go on and get out of here so I can have some lunch." This was typical Don Lawton. He was joking, but the other agents could tell he'd rather be working the follow-up car than staying at Love Field with Ribka advancing the departure. Sam Kinney, driving the follow-up car, focused on the back of the presidential limousine and its passengers, keeping as close to its rear bumper as possible to prevent another vehicle or even a person from separating the two cars. He also had to keep an eye on the agents hanging off the sides of halfback. If an agent jumped off the running board, headed for the president's car, Sam had to react in a heartbeat. The job of the team was to protect the president, but for God's sake, he didn't want to run over a Secret Service agent either. for Bill Greer, Sam Kinney, and the other Kennedy Detail Secret Service agents. The rest of the motorcade behind them was inconsequential. Their sole purpose, and the role for which they'd been handpicked and highly trained, was to make sure nothing happened to the man and woman seated in the back seat of that dark blue convertible limousine. Nothing else mattered. The motorcade proceeded like a long, slithering snake, traveling between 12 and 15 miles an hour, until it left the airport grounds and headed onto Mockingbird Lane to Lemon Avenue. The four police motorcycles escorting the president's limousine were strategically placed according to the White House advance manual, two on each side, positioned between the rear tires of the limousine and the front tires of the follow-up car, so as not to impede the movements of the follow-up car agents. The loud roar of the motorcycle engines, however, made normal conversation between the passengers in the cars nearly impossible. There were few spectators on this stretch of road, so Wynn Lawson told Chief Curry he could pick up the pace. "Keep it between 25 and 30 until we start to see some crowds," he said. He knew that as they got closer to downtown, the sidewalks would be filled. The publicity in the local news media had guaranteed that, and inevitably the procession would slow down. He had to keep an eye on the timing to make sure they didn't get too far off schedule. Bill Greer and Sam Kinney sped up at the same rate, maintaining a consistent distance between the vehicles. Clint Hill tightened his grip on the handhold as the car gained momentum. He moved his head constantly, his eyes scanning along the left side of the road, up ahead and then back again, the pink hat always within his gaze. She was no more than 5 yards in front of him, but she might as well have been on the other side of Dallas. "I shouldn't be this far away. I should be on the back of that limousine." The procession went along for several miles in this manner, passing used car lots, junk dealers, and auto parts stores. Every so often there'd be a handful of people waving or holding up a sign, and the president, Jackie, and Governor and Mrs. Connolly would all wave back. As the motorcade got closer to the city proper, the crowds multiplied, all of a sudden, it seemed, until there were people standing 2 and 3 deep along both sides of the road. "Okay, let's slow it down," Wynn Lawson directed to Chief Curry. Lawson turned around, and Bill Greer was already doing the same. The police chief gradually reduced the speed until he was going 12 miles an hour. The rest of the parade followed suit. Up ahead, Agent Lawson saw a group of children standing next to a large sign, about the size of a full-size bedsheet, on which was hand-painted, "Please, Mr. President, stop and shake our hands." Lawson had worked enough motorcades with Kennedy to know that the president responded to signs like this, and often he would indeed ask Bill Greer to stop the car. As they passed the group, Lawson looked back to the president's car. Sure enough, as soon as President Kennedy was close enough to read the sign, he said, "Bill, stop up here. Call these people over, and I'll shake their hands." A woman who was holding up one side of the sign squealed. "It worked! Our sign worked!" Suddenly, the crowd surged forward as children and adults alike raced toward the limousine. The policemen on the motorcycles had to stop abruptly to avoid hitting anybody. Within seconds, the well-meaning police officers were surrounded, unable to move. As Sam Kinney slowed down in unison with Bill Greer, the agents on the running boards, Clint, Jack, Paul, and Tim, leapt off the follow-up car. It took each of them just a couple of strides to reach the rear doors of the limousine, acting as a human barrier between President Kennedy on one side and Jackie on the other, seconds before the first spectators bombarded the car. President Kennedy stood up, leaned out the side of the car, and shook one hand after another, laughing as the children screeched with delight, while Jackie remained seated, offering a smile and a wave to the crowd that seemed to envelop the car. Clint Hill could see the unease in her eyes, even as she tried valiantly to smile to the crowd. He moved in close, and as she glanced at him, her anxiety seemed to disappear. "He shook my hand! The president shook my hand!" a little boy squealed. In the follow-up car, Dave Powers was recording some of the scenes with his home movie camera. He couldn't have scripted a better political commercial if he had tried. Just after a few seconds, President Kennedy turned to Bill Greer and said, "All right, let's travel on." The flags on the front hood of the president's limousine flapped wildly as Bill Greer drove the short block on Houston Street. To his left was Dealey Plaza, a three-acre triangular-shaped park of well-manicured grass, accented with concrete pergolas and walkways. Houston Street formed the base of the triangle, and up ahead, Greer saw the lead car making a sharp left turn. He'd studied the map and knew it was Elm Street, but having never driven the route before, he found the size and locations of the buildings, as well as the gradient of the roads, to be completely foreign. What he did know was how his behemoth limousine took turns, which was not very gracefully. The four passengers in the back of the limousine had been bantering back and forth for the past 6 miles. Nellie Connolly turned around in her seat and looked at Jack Kennedy. "You sure can't say Dallas doesn't love you, Mr. President," she said with a smile. "No, you can't," he replied. He'd had a permanent smile on his face since he got off the plane at Love Field. Maybe the pollsters had been wrong about Texas after all. Bill Greer slowed down almost to a crawl, conscious of the comfort of his passengers as he rounded the hairpin turn, 135 degrees to the left. The road sloped down ever so gradually, and he accelerated once again as soon as the car was on the straightaway. A woman in a red coat yelled out, "Hey, Mr. President, look over here!" In the follow-up car, Sam Kinney navigated the turn just as easily as Greer. Sitting in the front passenger seat, Emery Roberts heard Wynn Lawson's radio transmission that the motorcade was 5 minutes away and glanced at his watch. He looked down and wrote 12:35 on his itinerary, the time they'd arrive at the Trade Mart. "What a great crowd," Ken O'Donnell said to Dave Powers. "Sure is," agreed Dave. The 8mm movie camera was sitting in his lap. The agents in the follow-up car, like the drivers, had never driven this route before. But when they saw the freeway entrance up ahead, combined with the dwindling crowds, they knew the vehicles were about to increase their speed. Standing on the running boards of the follow-up car was exactly where they were supposed to be. On the front left running board, Clint Hill focused on the overpass ahead, looking for signs of anybody who might attempt something from that ideal vantage point. About 10 people and 2 police officers. No problem. He moved his gaze to the left, to the flat grass area that formed Dealey Plaza, where just a few people were standing and waving. Directly across from Hill, on the front right running board, Agent Jack Reedy was scanning the clusters of people standing on the sidewalk and seated on another grassy slope on the right-hand side of the street. The 4 motorcycle police were back in position, a few yards from the agents, their growling engines drowning out the cheers and greetings from the few spectators. Suddenly, above the noise of the motorcycles and beyond the screams of the adoring crowd, a sharp crack blistered through Dealey Plaza. The triangular canyon of buildings created an echo chamber that masqueraded the sound such that even many of the Secret Service agents, all of whom were expert marksmen with high-powered rifles, didn't recognize it as gunfire. Bill Greer, driving the president's limousine, thought one of the motorcycles had backfired, or that he had a blowout. He quickly tapped on the brake to see how the car would respond, but the car remained stable, so he continued on. "What was that?" Agent Jack Reedy blurted out. "A firecracker?" Paul Landis, standing just behind Reedy on the right running board of the follow-up car, was one of the few who recognized immediately that a rifle had been fired. Ironically, the night before in Fort Worth, he'd had a conversation with police officers who were talking about deer hunting. His thoughts had flashed back to the conversation, so when he heard the sound, he immediately recognized it as gunfire. His eyes went directly to President Kennedy, who, about 20 feet in front of him, appeared to be turning his head toward the right, in the direction from which the sound had come. Paul swung his head around over his right shoulder and looked back toward the innocuous brick building they'd just passed. He didn't notice anything unusual, so he scanned the small clusters of people on the grassy hillside, his gaze moving quickly to the latticed design wall and fence at the top of the hill. Still, there was nothing that seemed to have caused the loud crack. He began to think that perhaps the sound had been a firecracker after all. Clint Hill heard a sudden explosive sound from the right and to the rear. He instinctively moved his head in that direction. As his gaze crossed from left to right, he saw President Kennedy lurch forward, grab at his neck in a sudden strange motion, and then slump to his left. The average person might have screamed a profanity, but all Clint could think was, "Oh, God!" He leapt off the running board of halfback, as he'd done countless times before, his body reacting as it had been trained. In that terrible, unforgettable moment, Clint Hill had but one purpose. He had to reach Mrs. Kennedy and the president and shield them. His powerful legs propelled him toward the pink hat that seemed to be moving farther and farther away each time his foot landed on the pavement. If only he could reach the back of the car, his legs knew the exact height of the rear step. His hands knew exactly where to grasp the hand grip. As he bounded toward the limousine, which had slowed to about 7 miles an hour around the corner, but was starting to pick up speed, he had to run at the breakneck speed of nearly 15 miles an hour to adjust for the speed and the distance between the two cars. As his feet propelled him toward the moving car, Clint Hill was so focused on reaching his target that he didn't even hear the second shot. On the right front running board of the follow-up car, Jack Reedy had instinctively turned his head toward the Texas School Book Depository at the sound of the first shot. He was scanning the people on the right side of the street just as the sound of a second distinct rifle shot filled his ears. He whipped his head around and saw Clint running desperately toward the limousine. Follow-up car driver Sam Kinney's responsibility was to maintain his focus on the president's car. He saw Kennedy's reaction to the first shot, and then saw Clint leap onto the pavement a split second later. He immediately turned the follow-up car slightly to the right to clear a path for Clint to reach the president and first lady. His eyes were still focused on President Kennedy when he heard the second shot and saw Governor Connally slump toward his wife. Just as Clint's system rejected the sound of the second shot, so did Governor Connally's. When the first shot was fired, Connally immediately recognized it as a rifle shot. The sound came from behind. He looked back in a reflexive motion over his right shoulder to where the sound had originated, but saw only a few men, women, and children standing on the grassy knoll alongside the street. There was nobody holding a gun, and the sound seemed to have come from farther away. He turned forward again, and was just about to look over his left shoulder to make eye contact with President Kennedy, when he felt a crippling blow to his back. Like Clint, the adrenaline coursing through his veins threw his system into such shock that he never heard the sound of the second shot, the very shot that hit him. The instant Nellie Connolly heard the first shot, she turned her head to look over her right shoulder. The sound had come from the right rear of the car, and saw President Kennedy draw his hand to his throat. She turned to her husband, just as the sound of the second shot permeated the car. Immediately the governor doubled over, blood spilling from his chest. "Oh, no, 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 no!" he yelled, as he slumped toward Nellie. "They're going to kill us all!" ASAIC Roy Kellerman was sitting in the front passenger seat of the presidential limo, directly in front of Governor Connolly. He heard the first loud pop over his right shoulder, and as he turned his gaze back and to the right, he thought he heard the president say, "My God, I'm hit!" He swung around to his left to look into the back of the car and saw President Kennedy grasping at his neck. Kellerman grabbed the radio, turned to Bill Greer, and said, "Let's get out of here. We are hit." He pushed the transmission button, and there was no mistaking the urgency in his voice. "Lawson, this is Kellerman. We are hit. Get us to the nearest hospital, quick." As he was relaying the message, he heard one bang and then another, and as Greer tramped down on the accelerator, Kellerman felt the car burst forward with such thrust. Up ahead, the lead car was nearing the overpass when the first shot was fired. Through the open windows of the sedan, Agent Wynn Lawson heard the sharp report and turned to look back through the rear window. He could see some commotion in the president's car behind him. Then Kellerman's voice over the radio, "We're hit!" Lawson turned to Chief Curry and said, "Get us to the nearest hospital, quick." Sitting in the front passenger seat of the Secret Service follow-up car, ATSAIC Emery Roberts was recording the arrival time at the trademark on his notepad when he heard the first shot. He looked up and saw the president slump 5 yards in front of him. Clint Hill practically flew off the left running board, and in the same instant, the car swerved a little to the right, creating a clear path for Clint to reach the limousine. Emery was focused on Clint. "Faster, faster, come on, Clint!" when the second shot filled his ears. A feeling of dread washed over him as he saw Governor Connolly double over. Standing on the front right running board, next to where Emery Roberts was seated, Jack Reedy had one objective, to get to the president. He bent his knees and let go of the hand grip as his eyes focused on the back of President Kennedy's head. Emery could tell that Jack was about to leap, but the follow-up car was veering to the right. If Jack jumped, he'd be jumping directly into the path of his own car. Sam Kinney was focused on Clint and would probably hit Jack dead on. A sniper with a high-powered rifle had zeroed in on the open top car, and Emery knew that the only hope for the president was either for Clint to reach him or for Bill Greer to get the hell out of there. "Wait, Jack!" Emery called out, just as the third shot echoed through the canyon of buildings. With one hand on the rail, poised to save the president, Agent Jack Reedy watched John Kennedy's head explode into a grisly fountain of brains, bone, and blood. Behind him, Paul Landis sucked in his breath as the horrific image became forever etched into his soul. In the driver's seat of the follow-up car, Sam Kinney clearly heard the loud crack of the third shot. Like Jack Reedy, his gaze was transfixed on the president's head. When the bullet met its mark, he heard a sickening sound, like a melon shattering onto the pavement. And then Sam Kinney felt the warm blood of the president's head as it sprayed over the top of his windshield. Jacqueline Kennedy was facing to her left when the first shot was fired. As she turned to the right toward the sound, the president slumped to the left. Not knowing what was happening, she reached her right arm behind him, around his shoulders, just as the second shot hit the governor. She was staring into her husband's face just as the third and fatal shot hit the back of his head and splattered his brains in every direction. Clint Hill was just feet from his goal, his eyes focused on Mrs. Kennedy, when he heard the third shot and the gruesome thump of President Kennedy's head exploding. In one last desperate attempt, he stretched out his arms and wrapped his fingers around the handle as his foot found the step. His heart was pounding. He had made it, a split second too late. Paul Landis had been looking right at the president and trying to calculate whether or not he could get there. A million thoughts were swirling in his head. But Clint was already on the way. "Go, Clint! Go, Clint! Go!" And then he saw and heard the impact of the third shot. When Bill Greer had accelerated suddenly, he didn't realize that Clint was hanging off the back. The extra weight forced the car to lurch forward, and Clint's foot slid off the step back to the pavement. Still holding tight to the hand grip, Clint raced to keep up with the car as it gained speed. Jackie was screaming. "They've killed my husband! They've shot his head off!" She held out her white-gloved hand and yelled, "I have his brain in my hand!" Good God, what is she trying to do? She had jumped out of her seat and was climbing toward Clint onto the trunk of the car, her brown eyes filled with terror. She looked like she was going to leap onto the pavement, like she was searching for something. For God's sake, a sniper was shooting at the car. He had to get to her. Nothing else mattered. Clint lunged, and as the car sped toward the overpass, his foot landed on the footstep one more time. He thrust his body forward onto the trunk, grabbed at Jackie's arm, and desperately pushed her back onto the seat. She slid back inside the car and collapsed. Clint was clinging to the back of the seat, his body spread-eagled across the trunk of the car as it raced onto the freeway. He sucked in his breath as he saw the horrific scene inside the limousine, and slumped across the seat, President Kennedy lay unmoving, a bloody, gaping, fist-sized hole clearly visible in the back of his head. Clint, now desperately holding on to the top of the rear door with all the strength in his hand, with one leg hooked down into the rear seat and one foot outside the car, placed his body so it covered Mrs. Kennedy and the president. He turned back to the agents in the follow-up car, and with a look of complete hopelessness, shook his head and gave them the thumbs-down sign. Dave Grant looked up to see Admiral George Berkeley, carrying his black medical bag, rushing toward them. He had just arrived on the VIP bus moments earlier. Breathing heavily, he asked, "What hospital is the president going to?" "Parkland Hospital. Apparently it's not too far from here," Grant replied. "I have to get to him quick. I have his medication," Berkeley said, with a look of panic on his face. Admiral Berkeley was both anxious and irritated. Normally, the admiral rode in a staff car in the motorcade, or in the rear seat of the follow-up car. But he and the president's secretary, Evelyn Lincoln, had misjudged the timing of the motorcade's departure from Love Field, and wound up scurrying to the VIP bus. He was furious for not having been in his normal seat, but had nobody to blame but himself. His sole purpose for being in the motorcade was to be close to the president in case anything happened. But who could have predicted this? Berkeley had been the president's personal doctor since October 1961, and was the only one who knew all the medications Kennedy was taking, not only for his severe back pain, but also for Addison's disease, something that was known only by Kennedy's closest circle, including the agents. Parkland Hospital. 12:36 p.m. 6 minutes after the shots were fired, Chief Curry's lead car, the president's limousine, and the Secret Service follow-up car screeched up to the emergency entrance at Parkland Hospital.
Mrs. Kennedy, dazed and in shock, huddled over her husband, who was lying face up in her lap with his eyes open. A chunk of his hair-covered skull was on the seat next to him. In front of the Kennedys in the jump seats, Governor Connolly was semi-conscious, doubled over on his wife, Nellie. "Mrs. Kennedy," Emery said as gently as he could, "let us get the president." Her eyes were glazed over, and she clutched her husband even tighter, unwilling to let go. Clint Hill edged in next to Emery. "Mrs. Kennedy, please," Clint pleaded in a guttural voice. Dave Powers had jumped out of the follow-up car, and as soon as he saw the president lying lifeless in the back seat, he began sobbing. "Oh, Jack!" There was no doubt in Emery Roberts's mind that the president was dead. With the experience of having protected four presidents and an innate ability to make astute decisions in the face of disaster, Emery Roberts knew what he had to do next. His duty now was to protect the next in succession, Vice President Johnson. "You stay with the president," he said to Roy Kellerman. "I'm taking some of my men for Johnson." To some, his announcement may have appeared abrupt, but given the realities of the situation and the responsibility of the Secret Service, it was exactly the right thing to do. It was very rare for both the president and vice president to be together at the same time, in the same place, and Emery was extremely concerned that whoever shot President Kennedy might also be targeting the vice president. The way the jump seats folded out, Governor and Mrs. Connolly were blocking the path to the president. They had to get Connolly out first. Despite his severe injuries, Governor Connolly heard the discussion around him and mustered up every amount of strength possible to raise himself from his wife's lap. But he got only halfway and slumped against the door. "Governor, don't worry," Kellerman said, as he and Hill lifted him up. "Everything's going to be all right." The governor nodded as two other sets of hands helped lift him out of the limo, placed him on a gurney, and rushed him into the emergency room. Clint Hill and Roy Kellerman helped Mrs. Connolly get out of the car. She was unharmed, and despite what she'd just witnessed, was incredibly calm. Mrs. Kennedy still had not budged. Clint could tell she was in shock. She couldn't be expected to make any sensible decisions. But knowing her as well as he did, he knew that if anything, she was concerned with maintaining some semblance of dignity for her husband. There was nothing Clint could do to conceal the blood spattered on the pink designer suit Mrs. Kennedy was wearing. The best he could do now was get the president inside the hospital, with the remote hope there was something that could be done to save his life. He removed his suit coat and placed it over the president's head and upper chest to shield onlookers from the gory sight. He looked at Jackie, looked into the beautiful brown eyes, now filled with unbearable sadness, and said, "It's okay now, Mrs. Kennedy. Let us get him into the hospital." She looked at Clint and slowly nodded. Clint's jaw twitched as he struggled to force back the emotions that threatened to break through at any moment. Gulping hard, he turned to Wynne Lawson and said, "Wynne, move his feet. They're stuck under the seat." Agents Hill, Lawson, Kellerman, and the sobbing Dave Powers lifted the president out of the limo and placed him on the gurney as Bill Greer steadied it. When Agent Paul Landis helped Mrs. Kennedy out of the car, he saw a bullet fragment in the back where the top would be secured. He picked it up and put it on the seat, thinking that if the car were moved, it might be blown off. And then he saw the bloody Zippo lighter with the presidential seal on it. He picked it up and put it in his pocket. He picked up her hat and purse and brought them inside. The governor was already in trauma room number 2 on the left side of the hallway. The agents could hear his groans as they jogged the president's stretcher into the open room on the right, trauma room number 1, with Jackie clutching the side of the stretcher. She couldn't bear to let go. She had to stay with him. Trauma room number one was suddenly filled with white-coated doctors and orderlies. The small room was packed, and with the doctors needing to get to work immediately, the agents realized they needed to give the doctors space. Clint Hill urged Mrs. Kennedy to step outside with him, but she refused. "I'm staying in here with him," she said. Hill nodded. Admiral Berkeley decided to take charge. Mrs. Kennedy was right. Her husband's death was imminent, and she should be in there with him when he died. Roy Kellerman, standing nearby, followed Dr. Berkeley and Mrs. Kennedy back into the emergency room. A small army of doctors hovered over the president, still working valiantly to keep him alive. Berkeley stood stoically next to Mrs. Kennedy, wondering if he should put his arm around her. He'd never done it before, so it seemed inappropriate. Suddenly, she knelt down and prayed. As Mrs. Kennedy stood up, one of the doctors said, "It's no use. His life is gone." Dr. Berkeley edged in between two doctors and checked the president's vital signs. He took a deep breath, turned around, and stepped over to Mrs. Kennedy, who was looking at him with hope in her eyes. "I'm sorry, Mrs. Kennedy. The president is dead." She'd known he couldn't have survived. She'd held a piece of his brain in her hand. But still, to hear the words. Softly, she began to weep. The door opened and two priests walked in. They arrived a moment too late, but they immediately began to administer last rites. The doctors moved away so that Mrs. Kennedy and Dr. Berkeley could stand with the priests, and together they prayed. John Fitzgerald Kennedy, the President of the United States, was dead. "Clint, I need you to call a funeral home. We need to get a casket so we can get the president's body back to Washington as quickly as possible." He had to get a casket for the body of the president. A casket for the body of the president. At least he had a task. As long as he had a task for his mind to focus on, the other thoughts could be pushed further away. 2 minutes later, he was in a small office, on the phone with someone from the O'Neill Funeral Home. One of the hospital administrators had told him they were the best. "I need a casket delivered to Parkland Hospital's emergency entrance right away. The best one you have," he said. "It's for..." His voice started to break. "Stay on task. Stay on task. It's for the president." Clint hung up the phone and was standing, looking at nothing, seeing nothing. He walked back into the hallway and saw Mrs. Kennedy coming out of the swinging doors of the trauma room, followed by two priests. Paul Landis had not moved from his position outside the trauma room. "Mrs. Kennedy, why don't you sit down?" he said as he guided her toward the chair in the hallway. She reached for the chair as if to steady herself, and then sat down. Her shoulders drooped, and then she sat up straight and tilted her head up to the priests and thanked them for being there, for praying for the president. She was calm, but there was something different about her. What was it? Had she changed her clothes? And then Clint realized the blood on her suit and her face and her hands and her legs had begun to dry and was turning from liquid red to crisp brown. And then the two thoughts collided. We're heading back to Washington, the casket for the body of the president. Oh, God! His chest tightened as he strode back to the room with the phone. The White House was certainly the safest place for Carolyn and John John. Both agents agreed. But in the end, it was decided that they should be moved to Mrs. Kennedy's mother's home in Georgetown. If John John were at the White House, he'd hear the helicopter landing on the lawn and would be expecting to see his daddy. But this time, his daddy was coming home in a casket. for time and the world do not stand still. Change is the law of life, and those who look only to the past or the present are certain to miss the future. John F. Kennedy, Parkland Hospital, 1:15 p.m. In another corner of the hospital, Vice President Johnson was in the secured room with his wife, his executive assistant Cliff Carter, and Agent Youngblood, and still debating whether to take the president's plane back to Washington. When Emery Roberts walked in with Mac Kilduff, the assistant White House press secretary, and Ken O'Donnell, Johnson could tell by the looks on their faces that now it was a moot point. "President Kennedy has died," Emery said. "We need to discuss when and how to announce it," O'Donnell added. Emery glanced at O'Donnell, then turned his attention back to Johnson, and added, "Keeping in mind that right now the most important thing is your security," he almost added, "Mr. Vice President," as he normally would, but right now he didn't know what to call him. He was, for all intents and purposes, the President of the United States. He decided not to call him anything for the moment. "We still don't know who is behind this thing." After a short discussion, it was decided that for security reasons, Kilduff would not publicly announce President Kennedy's death until Vice President Johnson, who was constitutionally now the President of the United States, had left the hospital. "Mrs. Kennedy is insisting on staying with the President's body, but we need to get you back to Washington." "I can't leave her behind," Johnson said. "I won't do it." The various options were discussed, and Vice President Johnson finally agreed that he and Mrs. Johnson would go to Air Force One, but they would not allow the plane to leave without Mrs. Kennedy. "Stay on task." To his left he saw a hearse approaching, and looked down at his watch. 1:20 p.m. An hour ago the President was in front of him, waving to the cheering crowds. Now Clint was signing for his casket. Clint helped roll the 400-pound bronze coffin into the trauma room. Paul Landis and Ken O'Donnell saw the casket coming and tried to turn Mrs. Kennedy's attention away, but she immediately realized their humble attempt at a ruse. "I want to go in," she said. "Please, let me go in." "No, Mrs. Kennedy, I don't think..." She'd already made up her mind. This was her husband. She had to be with him one last time before he was gone forever. She forced her way back into the trauma room and watched as her husband was moved from the stretcher into the satin-lined casket. Four sheets had been wrapped around the president's head, and still the blood continued to soak through. The nurse who had tried to keep Mrs. Kennedy from entering the room had brought in a plastic mattress cover to be placed in the casket under the body, so the pale-colored interior wouldn't be spoiled. How odd, Agent Roy Kellerman thought, as the president's body was lifted into the coffin. Our president is dead, and the nurse is worried about stains. Meanwhile, Wynne Lawson had asked Sheriff Bill Decker to make the arrangements necessary for the president's body to be removed from Dallas and flown to Washington, D.C. Protocol had to be followed. Tensions were mounting from every angle. Still, nobody knew who was behind the assassination. The Kennedy detail agents needed to get Lyndon Johnson and Mrs. Kennedy the head Dallas, and Mrs. Kennedy wasn't leaving without her husband's body, and Lyndon Johnson wasn't leaving without Mrs. Kennedy. They had to get the casket out of the hospital and onto Air Force One as soon as possible. Roy Kellerman was waiting for the death certificate when a man barged into the trauma room, and after introducing himself as Dr. Earl Rose, the Dallas County Medical Examiner, he said, "You can't take that body. There's been a homicide here. We have to do an autopsy." "Sir," Kellerman said as he walked toward the man, "with all due respect, I'm the special agent in charge of the White House detail of the Secret Service. This is the body of the President of the United States, and we are taking it back to Washington." Roy Kellerman towered over the medical examiner, but neither his 6'4" frame nor his title seemed to intimidate Earl Rose. "This homicide happened in Dallas County," Rose insisted. "Under the law, there must be an autopsy." "We are taking the body," Admiral Berkeley said defiantly as he strode toward the two men. "Certainly this part of the law can be waived," Kellerman said. He was trying to remain diplomatic, but he was quickly losing patience. "If you want a waiver, you'll need a judge to overrule me," Rose said. "But I'm telling you, you can't break the chain of evidence. The autopsy must be performed here." Kennedy's advisors, O'Donnell, O'Brien, and Powers, couldn't take this nonsense. Did this lowly Dallas official realize who he was dealing with? Mrs. Kennedy had thus far been able to remain composed and was holding herself together remarkably well, but she was still in shock. She wasn't leaving Texas without her husband's body, and if they waited to perform an autopsy, who knew how long it might take? It was completely irrational. But Dr. Rose was adamant. "Texas law is clear when it comes to violent crimes. This was a homicide, and there must be an autopsy." "Oh, for God's sake," Ken O'Donnell said as he paced back and forth. "This is not just a homicide, Dr. Rose. This is the President of the United States. Do you realize what Mrs. Kennedy has been through? Certainly you don't expect her to wait around here for an autopsy." Meanwhile, the afternoon shift leader, Stuart Stout, had ordered the O'Neill funeral home driver to get out of the hearse. "We're taking over now," he said unequivocally. He told Andy Berger to get in and be ready to drive the hearse to Love Field as soon as the president's casket was loaded. Clint Hill had taken charge of securing the corridors between the trauma room and the loading dock for the hearse. The debate about whether the president's body could be removed had reached a crescendo, and it looked as if people were about to start throwing punches. Neither side was willing to back down, but at this point the Secret Service agents decided it was time to take control and worry about Texas laws later. Hill walked into the trauma room, where Kellerman was still with the president's body, and told him everything was clear for departure. Washington, D.C. Agent Lynn Meredith, another member of the children's detail, was at home in Arlington, Virginia, on his annual leave. His wife had been watching As the World Turns when Walter Cronkite interrupted the program and announced that the president had been shot in Dallas. Meredith immediately called Bob Foster, who told him they'd just decided to take the children to Mrs. Auchincloss's home in Georgetown. "I'm coming over," Meredith said. "Do the kids know?" "No," Foster said. "We're not telling them." "That would be great if you could come in. The plan is to take John John to the park this afternoon. Try to keep him in his routine. Carolyn is with Mrs. Auchincloss. She seems to have no idea." Parkland to Love Field. At 1:35 p.m., agents surrounded Vice President Johnson and accompanied him out of Parkland Hospital to a waiting unmarked police car, driven by Dallas Police Chief Jesse Curry. When the Vice President, Mrs. Johnson, and the agents accompanying them arrived, it was approximately 1:40 p.m., the Secret Service agents immediately closed all window blinds on the aircraft as the Vice President called Attorney General Robert Kennedy to ask about the legal aspects of taking the oath of office. Jesus Christ! LBJ had never imagined he'd be in this situation. He needed somebody to tell him what to do. What was the oath? Who could administer it? Back at Parkland Hospital, the situation over the removal of President Kennedy's body had escalated. Tempers flared and obscenities laced the conversation. The problem, it seemed, was that the murder of the President of the United States was not a federal crime. Thus, it had to be treated as an ordinary homicide in the state of Texas. In truth, Dr. Earl Rose had the law on his side. Admiral Berkeley had called a justice of the peace, in the hopes that he could overrule the medical examiner. But when the justice of the peace, Theron Ward, arrived, he agreed with Rose. In a homicide case, he had no choice but to order an autopsy. The good news, he said, was that it should take only 3 hours. 3 hours? Clearly, Justice Ward did not realize who he was dealing with. "You can't make an exception," O'Donnell implored. "This is President Kennedy." The young justice looked toward Dr. Rose and replied, "In the eyes of the law, it's just another homicide." O'Donnell was incredulous. Just another homicide? That did it. "Let's go," he said to Roy Kellerman. "We're leaving, and we're leaving now." Everybody in the presidential party agreed. They didn't have to put up with this. Clint Hill and Paul Landis stayed close to Mrs. Kennedy as the group marched through the empty hallways toward the hearse, waiting in the bay outside. Justice Ward stormed off to call Dallas County District Attorney Henry Wade. At the other end of the hall, the personnel officer of Parkland Hospital approached Agent Dick Johnson and handed him an expended bullet that one of his employees had found on a stretcher near the elevator. Johnson looked at it quickly, saw that indeed the end of the bullet had the telltale markings of one that had been fired, and realized it could be an important piece of evidence. Ordinarily, Johnson would have immediately written his initials on the bullet to show the chain of evidence, but with the chaos surrounding the removal of the casket, he took the bullet, wrapped it in his handkerchief, and stuffed it in his pocket. He would write his initials on it, but right now, there simply wasn't time. After the agents and President Kennedy's advisors had moved the heavy casket into the back of the hearse, Mrs. Kennedy declared she was going to ride in the back with her husband. "Mrs. Kennedy, we can follow in another car," Clint suggested. "I'm riding with him," she said. Indeed, Andy Berger, Stuart Stout, and Roy Kellerman felt the same. They weren't about to desert President Kennedy. Clint was trying to figure out how to handle the situation when Justice Ward came out and sheepishly announced that, yes, they could take the body. District Attorney Wade had agreed that if Dr. Berkeley accompanied the body from Parkland back to Washington and stayed with the body during the autopsy and agreed to return to Dallas to testify, Wade would allow the president's body to be released. This added a new dimension to the problem at hand. Admiral Berkeley had to be in the hearse with the president, too. There was no other choice. Andy Berger was at the wheel, with Stuart Stout and Roy Kellerman next to him in the front seat. In the back wagon portion of the hearse, where there were no seats, Admiral Berkeley climbed in first, then Clint helped Mrs. Kennedy and climbed in behind her, and together they sat on their knees, she still in her blood-stained pink suit, he with a borrowed coat he hadn't even remembered borrowing, and rode in the back of the hearse next to the dead president in the bronze casket from Parkland Hospital to Love Field. The hearse arrived at Love Field at 2:14 p.m. Andy Berger drove directly to the back steps to Air Force One. The Kennedy detail agents who were present removed the heavy casket from the hearse and then heaved it step by step toward the rear door of the plane. The agents were covered in sweat as the weight of the casket bore down on them, threatening to topple in any moment. And through the entire ordeal, nobody said a word. Paul Landis was nearing his breaking point as he stood with Mrs. Kennedy at the bottom of the portable staircase, watching the unfathomable scene. Several seats had been removed from the back of the plane to make room for the casket. But as the agents struggled to balance the nearly 600 pounds on their shoulders, when they got to the top of the stairs, the casket wouldn't fit through the door of the plane. The frustration of the moment was almost too much to bear. They had to get the casket on the plane. Somebody on the sidelines realized that it was merely the brass handle sticking out from each side that made the casket too wide for the door opening. and so they jammed the casket through the door, breaking off the handles and scraping the sides. There was no choice. The Secret Service agents had been trained to think of every possible scenario, to plan for every detail, to the minute. But nowhere in any training or manual was it ever mentioned that the width of the door on Air Force One was just a few inches too narrow for a casket. In the long history of the world, only a few generations have been granted the role of defending freedom in its hour of maximum danger. I do not shrink from this responsibility. I welcome it. John F. Kennedy. As soon as Vice President Johnson had been evacuated from Parkland Hospital, Mac Kilduff, the White House Assistant Press Secretary, held a press conference and announced to the media that President Kennedy had died at 1 p.m. Dallas time. Already less than an hour since the president had been shot, two-thirds of the adults in America had heard about it. Now the news was spreading around the world. From New York to London to Rome to Berlin to India, it seemed that time had stopped. People listening in their car radios pulled over and sobbed. Stores closed. Doctors canceled appointments. People gathered in coffee shops and living rooms, anywhere there was a television, and tried to comprehend how such a thing could have happened. For the first time ever, the three television networks halted normal programming and ran constant feeds from their newsrooms. The whole world seemed to be holding its breath. Nothing else mattered. 2:36 p.m. On Air Force One, Lyndon B. Johnson was about to take the oath of office with Dallas Federal District Judge Sarah Hughes presiding. 25 people had already crowded into the small stateroom of the presidential plane to witness the swearing-in ceremony. But Johnson wouldn't begin until Mrs. Kennedy came in. She'd gone into the presidential cabin to compose herself, and after combing her hair, washing her hands, and wiping the bits of blood off her face with a Kleenex, she'd asked for someone to get Clint Hill. "Yes, Mrs. Kennedy?" he asked as he walked into the room. She turned to him, grabbed his hands in her own, and looked up at him with hollow brown eyes. "What's going to happen to you now, Mr. Hill?" Tears welled in Clint's eyes. It was all he could do to hold it together. After all she'd just been through, how could she be worried about him? "I'll be okay." Ken O'Donnell walked into the room and said gently, "Mrs. Kennedy, the Vice President is waiting for you. He's ready to take the oath." As she walked out of the small bedroom, Jackie glanced back at the casket. Admiral Berkeley hadn't moved. He had vowed to remain with the President's body, and he wasn't about to leave his post. Dave Powers was now seated next to him. As soon as Paul Landis got on the plane, he just broke down. He'd been trying so hard to keep his emotions in check, but now, suddenly, as he sat down in an empty seat, he began sobbing uncontrollably. Glenn Bennett was sitting in the seat next to him, calmly making notes about everything. "He's keeping a clear head. Why can't I keep a clear head?" But no matter how hard he tried, the young agent Landis couldn't control his heaving sobs. At 2:38 p.m., White House photographer Cecil Stoughton captured the surreal scene of Lyndon Johnson, his hand on John F. Kennedy's Catholic prayer book, taking the oath of office, as Mrs. Kennedy stood next to him. Outside the scope of the lens, Clint Hill stood in the background with Paul Landis as Johnson became the 36th President of the United States. In the back of the plane, Mrs. Kennedy sat in a seat next to her husband's coffin, with Admiral Berkeley and Dave Powers next to her, and Agent Dick Johnson, with the bullet in his pocket, close by. Admiral Berkeley had been trying to get her to take a sedative ever since he arrived at Parkland Hospital, but she'd refused. She didn't want anything to drink or eat. At one point, someone brought her some coffee, and she occasionally took a few sips. Berkeley explained that it was mandatory to have an autopsy, but they had a choice of where it could be done. He could do it at the Army Hospital at Walter Reed, or at the Navy Hospital at Bethesda, or any civilian hospital. But really, the Admiral said, your husband was the President of the United States, and was therefore the Commander-in-Chief of the military. I feel that it should be done at a military hospital. Jack was a Navy man, she said. Let's have it at Bethesda. Powers said he'd call ahead to make the arrangements. As he walked to the front of the plane, he stopped at where Roy Kellerman was sitting. Roy, Powers said, Mrs. Kennedy has decided to have the autopsy at Bethesda. Kellerman nodded. And she's requested that you and the agents who were with the president carry him from the plane. She wants Bill Greer to drive. Dave Powers had been holding it together, but now his voice broke as tears streamed down his face. She said how much Jack loved Mr. Greer and all of you, and she knows how much you're suffering. They were both in agony, but there was no time to pause. They still had a job to do. They'd been instructed to report directly to the Dallas police headquarters to observe the questioning of a suspect who had already been captured. Although seeing Lee Harvey Oswald's arrogant behavior and hearing his snide remarks to Dallas investigators' questions triggered their anger, Wynne and Dave refused to let it influence their judgment about whether Dallas police had the right man. Lee Harvey Oswald certainly did fit the classic profile of an assassin, driven by a fanatical desire for recognition. But the seasoned agents knew physical evidence was also needed to prove Oswald's guilt. Clint got a call from Paul Lowenwater, a producer for the CBS television news magazine 60 Minutes. Lowenwater wondered if Clint would consider coming on the program to talk about his life in the Secret Service. The call took Clint completely by surprise. With the recent assassination attempts, he knew that the subject of Kennedy's assassination would undoubtedly come up. But 12 years had passed, and Clint was sure he could handle any questions asked. On October 8th, Clint and Gwen met reporter Mike Wallace, Paul Lowenwater, and a bunch of the staff from 60 Minutes, and the show was discussed in broad terms. It would be a taped interview. Gwen was welcome to be there, too. And the focus would be on Clint's career in the Secret Service, which spanned 5 presidents over 16 years. President Kennedy's assassination was barely mentioned. And by the time the meeting was over, both Clint and Gwen were looking forward to the interview. It sounded like fun. On Sunday, October 12th, Clint and Gwen drove to the Madison Hotel in Washington for the taping. Before the interview began, Gwen pulled Mike Wallace aside. Mike, she said, I know it's not apparent on the outside, but I just wanted you to know that Clint is emotionally fragile. Please take it easy on him. He's had a rough time recently. Clint and Gwen sat together on a sofa, with Wallace to their left in a wingback chair. Clint lit up a cigarette as the taping began, and the interview started off just fine. Wallace made him feel completely at ease. There were questions about his background, why and when he entered the Secret Service, followed by a few questions about the recent assassination attempts on President Ford. Gwen's words must have had an impact on Wallace, because when he came around to asking about the Kennedy assassination, he merely glossed over it and moved straight into how Clint wound up becoming the special agent in charge of President Johnson's detail. When the interview was finished, Clint breathed a sigh of relief and thanked Wallace and the rest of the crew. It had gone very well, and Mike promised to call Clint to let him know when the story would air. A few days later, Clint was sitting at home when the phone rang. Hills, Clint answered. Hi, Clint, it's Mike Wallace. Hey, Mike, how are you? Clint assumed Mike was calling to tell him when the interview would be airing. Well, I'm fine, Clint, Wallace began. But it seems we've had a slight problem. Wallace explained that when they went back and reviewed the tapes, there were some technical problems, and they needed to reshoot some portions of the interview. He wanted to set up a date, again at the Madison Hotel. Wallace would treat them to lunch beforehand. Clint didn't think anything of it, and readily agreed. Before Wallace hung up the phone, he added, "Oh, and one last thing. Please be sure you and Gwen both wear the same clothes as you did for the first interview, as we'll be editing the two tapes together." So when the day came, once again, Clint put on his light gray plaid suit, a white shirt, and his rust-colored tie, while Gwen wore the powder blue two-piece pantsuit with the floral print blouse. At noon, they walked into the restaurant at the Madison Hotel and were surprised to see not only Mike Wallace and Paul Lowenwater already seated at the table, but also 60 Minutes executive producer Don Hewitt. The menu featured steak tartare, which was one of Clint's favorite dishes. Mike Wallace ordered before Clint, and when he ordered the steak tartare, Clint laughed and said, "Well, that's exactly what I was going to have." The waiter told them it was a very large portion, enough to serve two people. So Wallace said, "Well, why don't we split it then?" The conversation was casual and comfortable as the men from 60 Minutes explained how the taping would work, while Clint and Mike Wallace shared their meal of raw beef and minced onions. They finished lunch and moved into the small banquet room where the lights and equipment had already been set up. When they walked into the same room where they'd done the first taping, everything looked exactly the same, with the exception that this time Don Hewitt was there. Clint made a joke about how it felt like déjà vu, and they took their places, Clint and Gwen on the sofa, with Mike Wallace to the left in the wing-back chair. Once again, Clint lit up a cigarette as the cameras started taping. Wallace eased in with a few questions, similar to what he'd asked in the first interview. And then, out of the blue, he said, "Can I take you back to November 22, 1963? It wasn't a question. It was a statement. Mike Wallace was about to take him back to that dreadful day in Dallas. Gwen could sense Clint suddenly stiffen, and her heart started racing. "Oh, no," she thought. Clint took a deep breath and closed his eyes. Without waiting for Clint to respond, Wallace continued, his voice coming out like rapid fire. "You were on the fender of the Secret Service car right behind President Kennedy's car." Clint turned his gaze down at his knees, unable to look at Wallace. His eyebrows shuddered as a pained expression washed over his face. The cameraman zoomed in for a close-up, as Wallace's words hit Clint like a round from a machine gun. "At the first shot, you ran forward and jumped on the back of the president's car, in less than 2 seconds, pulling Mrs. Kennedy down into her seat, protecting her." Clint reached for his cigarette and took a long drag. He blew out the smoke, and as he stared into nothingness, Wallace continued. "First of all, she was out of the trunk of that car," Wallace stated. Clint suddenly interrupted. "She was out of the back seat of that car, not out of the trunk of that car." His head was trembling, and his eyes had gone numb. He still couldn't look at Wallace or at the camera. His mind was back in Dallas, reliving those endless seconds. Wallace attempted to clarify. "Well, she had climbed out of the back, and she was on the way back, right?" Still looking down, Clint nodded. His face had contorted into a pained expression, his brow furrowed, his cheeks taut. Clint, visibly tormented, said, "And because of the fact that part of her husband's head," he paused, and his face winced into a painful grimace, "had been shot off and had gone off into the street." Incredulous, Wallace asked, "She wasn't trying to climb out of the car?" Clint was shaking his head, still looking at the floor, his eyes reddening as the memory flashed like a vivid movie in his mind. She was simply trying to reach that head, part of that head. The look on Clint's face was gut-wrenching. Gwen sat frozen. Her heart broke for Clint. "To bring it back?" Wallace asked. "That's the only thing," Clint said. His head dropped as he winced. Torment was written all over his face, as the emotions he'd suppressed for all these years came flooding out in one sudden tidal wave. It was so poignant, so visceral, that Wallace himself had begun to tear up. "Clint," Wallace said, "let's take a break. Stop the cameras." Clint stood up and took a deep breath. He didn't know what had come over him. He had to get control of himself. He walked out into the hallway, away from the bright lights and the cameras, as Gwen followed behind. She didn't know what to say. She had never talked to Clint about the assassination. They had never discussed it. She had no idea he would react like this. Wallace came into the hallway and offered some words of empathy. He knew how difficult this had to be for Clint, to talk about the tragedy in front of the cameras.
Well, that was a lot of information. Sadness. Blog Talk Mom?
That was very interesting. I've gone to the library. There's about at least three, maybe more, DVDs about Kennedy's life, about his father, and he's fascinating, absolutely fascinating person, president, and the insight that this broadcast is very pertinent, you know, about the people that were right there close to him, because we were all affected. It was just unbelievable how it affected everyone in our circle, but you just don't think about the people that were right there working with him and feeling the responsibility and always wondering if he could have done something else, or, you know, that was very interesting, a different insight, different perception.
I was only 3 and a half, and I remember it being on TV. It had to be one of the most, I don't know, it was really devastating to the country.
He was such a charming person. The interviews that he did, he was just delightful. In the DVDs that I watched, he could just charm everyone when they would interview him. He turned it in for something that was, you know, usually sort of boring and, you know, a lot of facts and whatever. And he had everybody laughing. And it was just, he was a delightful person. And, you know, we can take anyone in history and rip them apart and criticize, but he definitely, greater love hath no man than to give his life, and he did. And that was interesting how she was able, I didn't ever realize that until this program, how poised she was and how, you know, how many things was demanded of her right there at that point, and how she rose to the occasion. That was very interesting. Gives us insight to the great character of people that lead our country.
We have Bob Bell. Bob Bell?
Yeah, hello. I tell you what, that thing, I don't know, but it's one thing to read history, and then it's another thing when you can feel the emotions of the people that's there. And I don't know if it's because I've read so many police reports and things and wrote police reports from working law enforcement, that the way it was presented speaks to me just so powerfully, because I realized how that, you know, the mass confusion, everybody looks at some of these things to make a conspiracy, and all these things that were going on. I mean, it just, when you realize that the process of when the first shot to the last shot was 6 seconds, period of time, you know, when they rounded that corner, that all this happened. I mean, you know, it's one thing to sit there and tear something down and try to re-digest it and make it into all these different things, and it's another to try to put yourself in these people's shoes and realize what was going on. You know, it's been just a beautiful, perfect day. You know, everything looking good for the campaign. The president's happy. They're inside of the interstate, and then everything falls apart. And then that interview, you can go on YouTube and actually watch that interview with Flynn Hill. That 12 years later, and you can read this book, too. It's a very, very good. There's a lot of other information in there called the Kennedy Detail. But it covers that interview was 12 years later. And come to find out, Flynn Hill had never spoken to anybody about what happened that day. That was his very first time to verbalize what had happened. He had wrote his report. He had made his notes. He had done his job. And then he couldn't deal with it. He had to end up retiring from the Secret Service at the age of 43 because he had pretty much had a breakdown. Became an alcoholic. It almost, you know, destroyed his life because he could not get over this one event. And so, you know, it's just, I wanted to make it just more real. There's a lot of people talking about Kennedy because of this coming up on 50 years from the day he was assassinated. And, you know, just to give people a viewpoint that's a little bit different than what they may have heard before. And so I understand some of it was graphic, and I hope it didn't offend anybody. And I tried to clean it up as much as possible, but it seemed like the country was more in a time of innocence at that time. The people on the street when they came to see the president, did you hear what they were saying? The women were all wearing dresses. You know, they're wearing their nice dresses. The men were, a lot of them were wearing ties and suits to stand on the street to watch the president. Man, how times have changed. And thank you, Charlie. You did such a good job playing all those clips and everything, too. That was a lot of stuff to put together for this show.
Well, thank my computer. I wasn't sure that sometimes it stalls out. And anyway.
Blog Talk Mom, can you share with everyone just real short the difference in what's going on now as far as conveniences and things and what there was in 1963. Like, for instance, with the airplane, you know, we have jetways now. You know, I've seen all those old movies and stuff where they roll the stairs out to an airplane. I can't imagine those poor Secret Service agents trying to carry that 600-pound casket up. Because the pictures I've seen of those, they're usually really, really steep.
I really wouldn't be the one to. I thought you did an excellent job of that about the television, and I was 23 years old, and I was expecting your sister, and a lot of things was going on. We lived in an upstairs garage apartment. Jim had just started working at Roadway, and our life was just very simple. Life, but I do know that when the assassination took place, it made everybody it was such a reality check as far as everyone. Nothing seemed to, like, you know how people are caught up in their own world and they've got their own agenda, but it just seemed like it just stopped, and that's all anyone thought about. It was so real that we, and now it's even, we're living in a time that things were so busy. I mean, everyone, statistically, if you looked at so many different things that are taking place in our society, boundaries are being removed. The media pretty much sets the pattern for how people dress and how people think and what's cool and what isn't. Like you mentioned about them dressed, see, the world then dressed like the church now, and now we're still dressing that way, but we're odd, or like we've got some kind of agenda. We didn't change, you know, everybody else did, but it's I guess everybody has just come to the place now that it's scary to me. It's frightening to me that we don't seem to, I guess because of so many abortions and so many things that have taken place, that we've become sort of hardened. We say things, harsh things about our leaders and about people that are in authority, and instead of there being compassion and caring. Of course, we know that he was assassinated. Lincoln was assassinated, and there's going to be people that are radicals. But then you look at all the young men and women that have given their life in war. You know, I mean, it's just man's inhumanity to man is the saddest, most baffling thing that there ever was. Man's inhumanity to man. But I really appreciate you did it. Well, Bill, you did a lot to put this together, and Starley, you did too. I'm just fascinated about how you did that, and I do appreciate it very much. And it brought back a lot of thoughts, a lot of seriousness that was in our lives at that time. So thank you again, and I guess I'll call it a night.
Did we have anybody else that had anything they wanted to share, Starley? Anybody else have a hand up? Or?
No.
All right, well, again, I want to apologize for the length of the show, but I wanted to give as much detail as possible because I know some of the things that have to do with conspiracies, and I wanted to cover some of those things as they actually happened according to the Secret Service agents that were there, so you could go back and kind of relook at those conspiracy things. So, Carla, I turn it back over to you if you got anything else to say, and I just want to thank all of you and hope you're back with us next week.
Well, we want to thank everyone for listening, and God bless you, and have a good night.